another episode of Tennessee Fro is Reading. I'm your host, Felicia Baxter. In this episode, I will be confronting something that I never knew. Crackheads never went out of style in the Southeast. And COVID really does reveal stupidity. I'll be ending with final remarks about the becoming of Katie Brenner in Sophie Kinsella's wonderful book, My Not So Perfect Life, as well as why and my process of remaking a docuseries or a series based on Henry James Washington Park. And I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I have enjoyed creating it. Thanks. So as part of my general hustle, I am most excited about what I have to do to continue to create content. And it requires that, number one, I continue to do my day job well, but I also gather up content and support from other sources. For a minute there, I tried Fiverr. That was exciting, but I'm limited by my day job. However, there's certain ways that you can actually publish links, Instagram, Facebook, on your blog, that will allow you to fund your passion project. Writer's Block Coffee is one of those things. Not only will it allow me to benefit from my own purchases, I'm actually my best customer, but it also supports what my intent is for this coffee. Writer's Block Coffee has actually been trademarked, and its mission in the industry is to supply writers and those working inside the publishing industry with finest coffee, provide revenue opportunities like me to publishers and other businesses through coffee products. And it's supporting book marketing efforts with custom label coffee, which I am drinking as we speak. Writer's Block Coffee bridges a gap between the coffee and publishing industry. Coffee shops are great for hosting writing and reading activities, but their services stops at the door. That's where Writer's Block Coffee starts. By offering coffee for every stage of a book's life, from the writing to the marketing, Writer's Block Coffee reimagines the role of coffee as a partner and not an accessory. This experience informs every step of Writer's Block Coffee takes, from the taste of the coffee to the shape of the partnership. And I am a proud publisher of the links for you to enjoy this coffee too. So navigate to writersblockcoffee.com/tenfroisreading to find out about this, as well as the swag, and also enter the Tenfro is Reading promo code in to get 10% off of your order and shipping. And tell them that Felicia sent you. So welcome back to this part of the podcast. In the past several weeks, we've all been on self-quarantine and self-quarantine by our respective state governments. But I've had reason to get used to the workings of a real neighborhood. For you see, I have property in the Southeast outside of an apartment in Chattanooga. And we are Chattanooga strong because they just had some severe weather. And I escaped there to only come to North Carolina, where there was several reported tornadoes on the ground between South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina. So with that said, but I had escaped prior to that, and I'm getting used to being back in the neighborhood and getting to know, and in a peripheral way, people in the neighborhood. And what I can say of this neighborhood, it's decidedly darker. Since I first moved out here. There has been a decided change in the flavor of this neighborhood. And granted, it was always seemed different to me. But what I wasn't used to is the roaming crackhead of the neighborhood. Someone approached me last week, very helpful, with a promise of cleaning up my yard, keeping the yard cut, hard on their luck, originally from Memphis, had me at Memphis, came out here to work, but the person never paid them. So he was just making his way in the world. Relatively homeless, lived near the graveyard. I'm like, all right. Did an amazing job cutting my grass, cleaning up the leaves that the previous person had just blown against the fence and behind my shed. I'm going to pay you, and I'm going to tip you. Don't mind. And I'm also going to give you extra money if you want to buy your own blower so you can keep it going. I also understand that you also, quote unquote, rent somebody else's lawnmower so then you can do my yard. I'm okay with that. And I've seen you almost every day for the last 3 days on in this neighborhood. So if you come back and you want to borrow my blower that I know you I have, you know, I'm actually kind of okay with that. I just think it's weird. What I'm not okay with is you keep coming back saying you just need $40 more for a blower that you never buy because it is no longer on sale. And then you said, are you okay with me using your blower? Are you okay with me taking it and bringing it back after an hour for you too, so I can do some other work on somebody else's lawn? I'm like, okay, I'm figuring I'm okay with you borrowing it because you have been trustworthy all these days. And how far can you get? You won't foot. So an hour turns into 3 hours, turns into 4 days. Then you roll back, and I've already gotten a list of the pawn shops because I'm like thinking to myself, number one, what's the possibility that this has been jacked? And this person has absconded with my shit. Granted, it was over about 4 or 5 years old that I bought the thing from Home Depot, probably on sale. I don't remember, but it was mine not to use. So what if, but I'm always prepared that it was also a Husqvarna and it was pretty much brand new. There was a possibility I knew I wasn't going to get it back. What I wasn't prepared for is this joker showing up on Monday morning with some spiel about he's so sorry. His cousin stole and pawned it. Really? And he needs only $37 to get it out. Well, so it's at the pawn shop up the road next to Rose's, right? Well, I don't really know. And I'm like, well, no problem. I'll go up there and get it myself. Plus, again, there's only 4 or 5 places and probably the farm tool place that will buy used equipment from you. And as I said, that blower is basically brand new. I've only cranked it 4 times myself. So his story just kept getting more convoluted and janky. If it was your cousin, I didn't know you had people around here. You told me you were from Memphis. That's strike one. And I had already figured out last week after the second time talking to him, he's actually Native American. He's probably a member of that Lumbee tribe that's actually here, that's local to here. And number two, And if it really was your cousin, and if I go try to go, he says, well, it's under my cousin's name. And please don't go there and try to get it out because then, you know, he could potentially be arrested because he actually stole somebody's stuff. They could pick him up. Means he probably has a rap sheet. That didn't really shock me. And I'm also questionable if they actually have his ID on file, but I thought you actually had to have identification to at least pawn anything. And he says, well, it's under his name. And I'm like, well, if I give the description, that means it's stolen. Well, that means they'll call the cops on him, meaning they're going to call the cops on you because you did abscond with my lawn equipment. And he says, well, I apologize. I said I was sorry. I don't see where I did anything wrong. You know, and then this is what also flips me out. He said he tried to kind of weasel it in there that he couldn't understand why I would not give him more money to pawn, to get my stuff out of pawn. That he stole from me, because he tried to flip it on me. Well, it wouldn't have gotten stolen if I hadn't gone up the road to get that screwdriver. No, bro, slow your roll. Actually, you did not have to go up the road and take my blower with you, because I know when you came back the second time after I had already completed, because it was 4 hours later, you could have left the blower at my house at that time. I had already paid you $50. And I completed the job. You did not have to take my blower the second time. And it wasn't like I was giving you a free pass to use my blower and not to come back. If you consciously made the decision to take the blower off the property, knowing that you were going to not return in a timely manner, that's on you. That is your bad decision making. That's not on me. Also, bro, if you knew you were going to try to steal it, don't try to play me and then make up excuses why I should forgive you for stealing my stuff and why I shouldn't. And it's my blower and it's my money. Don't cock an attitude, because I'm not going to give you my money to get out of hock the stuff that you stole from me. Who does that? And I have not dealt with crackhead knowledge in a number of years, since I had to deal with a crackhead pregnant lady explaining to me why she had to blaze up when she was actually in labor. That to me was crazy. This conversation, you know, just was leaning to the absurd. It is my fault that I stole from you, and you need to give me the money so I can take more money to get the stuff out of hock that I stole from you. We're not related. I wouldn't do that for my own relatives. And only someone with substance abuse, probably a crackhead, meth head, one and the same. They all have the same thing. They cannot, they have no impulse control, immature, and no complete decision-making capabilities, because they make wrong and bad decisions. And that is what ails me to this point. Number one, when I do go pick this up, I will be properly arming myself, because people are getting desperate. They're worse than these damn rats. And that's all I got to say about Crackhead Dan. So me and Crackhead Dan are on the outs. I told them, don't let me see you on my property anymore, because then I'm calling the cops. I'm just done, through. It's a wrap for me. But on the other front, COVID is acting like a drug, and it's showing disparity. We got our dumbass president threatening to possibly fire the voice of reason because he is telling the truth. So the current problem going on now, besides everything dumbass 45 says and does and his sycophant administration, we've seen a resurgence of the disease in Japan, Korea, and China, and how we all know the misinformation in Russia trying to debunk American science has also led to the resurgence and the prevalence of this it just seems too much of a perfect virus to me, but that's the tone and the discussion for another episode. So the whole point that is going on now is that you can't have someone that's supposedly a leader that says stuff like, well, it's up to the states to get their own medical supplies and take care of themselves and enforce all of this shutdown and contain this. It's not my problem. But then you flip side, you says, well, I'm the number one ace boom coon in charge to reopen the government and do X, Y, and Z. Nah, bro, you can't have it both ways. And we all know that you are too stupid to understand what the data and the implications and contingency and unexpected result of decisions. You don't have that type of complex thought process. So anything you could come up with is not going to make sense. And if you basically had it in yourself to hand it over to someone that really knows what the fuck that they're talking about, this would not be a problem. We know that everything that you do is for re-election, and I'm hopeful to God that you won't get re-elected. You are basically putting all of the nails in your own damn coffin, and also to increase your wealth. But not unbeknownst to any of us and the rest of us, you are inept, and it's not going to go. You are not going to be able to successfully open up the government when all of the workers and potential parts of those sectors are all either dead or ill. That's just number one, ace, boom, coon. Also, shame on the people of Florida and now Michigan. How you basically BSing when you basically, they're closing down the big super box stores and not other non-essential carpet stores and furniture stores, and she's saying that you can't go out on your boat and your house because, again, that's probably a potential vector for spread, and how are you exempt from any of that, you dumbass, rich, stupid, conservative dumbasses? Who does that? Only people, only rich people, just rich, stupid people, entitled people would think that is such a bad thing. And we, the rest of us, are tripped out because we like, what the hell took your ass so long? And why is it April 14th and you just shutting down the rest of that shit? We all knew it should have been shut down a month ago. And now y'all the hardest hit and you moaning and complaining about the new surges of death. There's no flattening of the curve. It's you and that crazy lady. It's not Minnesota. Is it Wisconsin? Or Montana? Nope, it's Montana. You are doing some do stupid wilding out crap and you're making all women look bad. This lady is trying to hold on and do the right thing and make the right decision, but at the same time, her decision is coming late, and her citizens are wilding out at something that we all know inherently is needed. How dare you? And shame on you for being so short-sighted and violation of your constitutional rights. You rich mugs, go and sit down somewhere. Just go shut up and stop talking and leave that lady alone, because she should have did it a while ago. And how dare you think you are exempt from the same lockdown that the rest of the country has been dealing with for now over 70 some odd days. How dare you? But that's some entitled bullshit right there. And it blows my mind. Again, this COVID, even though we know it's an equal opportunity stalker, we still got some people to think that they are completely exempt. And you're going to pay for it, and pay for it in spades. And I wish the rest of the states that border along Michigan and all these dumbass states, they basically shut off their ability to get the fuck out. Because if you get to stay in and... in your stupidity. You are quarantined because you are stupid. So with that said, I'm going to have to leave it alone. My blood pressure going up. I'm tired of dealing with stupid. Crackhead knowledge and COVID stupidity. I just can't. I just can't. So welcome back to this part of the podcast. And I'm Tennessee Fro, and I'm reading. I'm still reading Sophie Kinsella's My Not So Perfect Life. And it was initially when I started reading this book, I was actually coming up with the list of why I hated one of the main characters, Demeter. Demeter is actually the boss of Katie Brenner. And it seems like through an intentional, unintentional will of her own, even though she is brilliant and talented and revolutionary and she's very creative, she is like on the autistic spectrum. She, in an effort to protect people, she forgets to let them know that she's protecting them. This is her personal assistant, her kids, her husband. They forget to see her as the vulnerable woman she is and the creative that she is. She just ticks them off and she keeps running over people, and she can't really understand why everybody is so pissed off with her. So again and again, Demeter continues to write her own firing. And that's where I left it off as far as part or chapter 18 or 19. Katie Brenner is forced to leave London because she loses her job. She goes back to her father's farm that he and her very talented stepmother turn into a glamping paradise. She helps them set up their website. She makes a go about setting up real yurts and create a country experience with great Wi-Fi. And of course, she creates a pamphlet before she gets fired, and she leaves it with Demeter, who haphazardly finds it and brings her family to stay over a holiday. It's also during this time that Demeter demands special treatment, and Katie definitely treats her to it, which I think is completely hysterical because she takes her on these things that are meant to break her, getting her stuck in quicksand, druid dances. It's hysterical. But what trips me out is you get a realistic look at Demeter's. It's really Demeter's not so perfect life, because her kids are baby kids. They don't die and they don't multiply because of fertility issues with the families. I'm sure Demeter probably had to take fertility pill to have the mugs. Her great husband sacrificed so Demeter could be at her ad agency, but he actually has a job in Brussels that he actually takes after guilting her into feeling bad about holding up his career, even though he decided to do that to promote her career. Her career is on the skids because of her ineptitude in recognizing social cues, where her personal assistant and everybody in that office has come to sabotage her and are meaningfully and willfully bringing the whole company down around her ears, and she doesn't even realize it because she's so content at maybe her ideas are so great that why would they hate me so much? Well, they all hate her, and they have all good reasons to hate her. Granted, she may have some good ideas, and she may be a halfway fabulous and great person, but she's also a horrible individual because she does some really mean things to people maybe unintentionally, but just by being careless and dismissive. One of the reasons why I constantly go back to, and I'm glad I've been able to follow and read Sophie Kinsella since her Shopaholic days, is because her characters seem to be very realistic. And granted, I like British, or I'm an Anglophile, but at the same time, I like her characters just because they are realistic and truthful. Her dialogue is meaningful and is also believable. They all is a distinct tone that carries through the entire book, and you can see the characters develop into their own. There's always an angst about not being good enough or measuring up, being mindful of others and not wanting to hurt your parents. And she does, Sophie Kinsella, that is, does always seems to do a really good idea about building the character of her characters and navigating very difficult family situations. And they always end up growing better, stronger, and together. And that's why I think this book is just so readable, and you have to read it because of finding, as you find the main character, who in this case is Katie Brenner, she is hysterical. She wants to give it a go and have a career in London, but the career that she imagined for herself is so far away from London, and she's but it's crazy because everything she learned in London, she's brought it back to her home town of Somerset, and in effect becoming the best that she can be, or the best version of herself, in the exact same place that she's trying to run away from. And eventually, I don't know, because I still have several chapters to finish up in the book before I realize what she actually is going, how it's all going to end out. Because in the chapters that I've read, she does hook up with Alex Astor, whatever his name is. He does end up firing Demeter. And so there's a lot of loose ends in the book. Will she end up with Alex? Will Demeter get her job back? Or will Demeter end up on top and create her own agency and allowing Katie to run it? And will Katie will then have to split her time between the Anstor's farm or her family's farm, as well as London? I think I like that latter one better because it makes sense. Because it seems like she came into her own. She became healthier and happier when she was actually at the successful glamping enterprise of her family. And maybe that will be her stick. Maybe she will allow, or her and her family will be able to show other people how to be renewable and organic and allow people to leave the hubbub of London and other major cities like London and Birmingham and come into their own, into the country. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of this book just for that reason. And that's why I'll give this book 5 stars, because she always comes through with these relatable and well-rounded characters. And it just makes an enjoyable read in this time of angst. So rounding out this part of the episode, I was able to complete the rest of my not so perfect life. And it just came up, or just gave me an idea about how to go about in this age of Tennessee Froe's reading and talking about these books now that Star Trek has gone off, Picard has gone off. So I basically can record different parts of it as I complete the reading, and this would also give me the incentive to complete the reading itself. But this particular book, I realized, and one of the things that I did when I finished actually reading it, listed in the back is an excerpt from the next Sophie Kinsella book, as well as a list of a list of the books that she's actually already written and published. And I realize I've read most of those books from cover to cover because of how she, the stories themselves were simplistic. Based on possible realistic persons, all the characters were relatable. She basically highlighted as a way, and based on when and where they were published, all of the characters were really realistic. The Shopaholic series was also in London at the go-go days of overextension and credit and high fashion at the time. I think both of those were published during the time of the publication of Sex and the And she basically highlights the knobbly bits or nibbly bits, the positive, the shiny bits, and the actually the real bits of life. She uses social media, how Instagram allows people to create, or just social media in general, create a glitzy life that nobody can live up to, trying to conceal who you really are instead of letting you become a better version of yourself, even though it's not the same as what most people get to relate to or can do the rest of their life. She started out with the hashtag My Not So Perfect Life, and it basically caught on, and through that hashtag she was actually able to celebrate and become the real Katie Brenner and reconnect with her friend Fi that's in New York. And it's through that Fi related to her that she did have the quirky friends and she had margaritas in the Hamptons one time, but for the most part she lived in a puny one bedroom small New York apartment. And now every aspect and everything she did was as fabulous as she made out to be. And they were able to even develop an even better friendship, or a true friendship, because of it. What cracked me up is how well-rounded and realistic and relatable her characters are. The humanness, they say some dumb shit and they do some dumb shit, but they at the same time, they redeem themselves because they own it and they grow beyond it. And just the humanness and the willing to grow and the compassion that of her characters allow you to go full in on them and for you to be able to read the story. And it's her books that are truly a manifestation or reflect the times that they're in. It's not complete total millennials, because I think she's a little bit older. She basically has these adaptable characters within right where they are, like right now. The story ends, Demeter is literally saved by Katie as she becomes or reverts back or discovers that she has always been Katie Brenner, because Katie Brenner would have never helped Demeter, but a strong and loved Katie Brenner helped Demeter in spades, not only save Demeter's job, but also help her family establish a successful glamping business, which I think is pretty awesome. And discover the love of her life through one, Alex, and uncover this mean girl conspiracy where Flora and Rosa and Sarah, they all had it out for Demeter. They wanted to get her fired. And they conspired to basically get rid of so much business in an effort to just get rid of this one girl. And basically they suss it out, come up with a plan that was activated by Katie, who almost becomes like a superhero in this book, because she straight away, she understood the importance of just doing the right thing. And she was able to execute it, unbeknownst to them, so perfectly, as herself, as Katie Brenner. The other shocking person that comes, that shows strength, is the character Biddy, her stepmother. She allows her to give her an excuse to put off the head of Cooper Clemens, I think it's called, the head of that particular company, as a way to allow Demeter to build her case and execute the almost perfect plan. And the girls are just so stupid that they could never recognize or that they were themselves being played. And I thought it was just absolutely brilliant. But Demeter does, not only, it was difficult for her to celebrate, because she was like, well, how can she celebrate when she realized that it basically over half of her department had it out for her and wanted to get her fired. But it ended up turning around, and Katie got the best job ever. She became a creative director and got to work with Demeter. Even though Demeter was at times could be dismissive and scatty, she still learned so much from her and could appreciate just how creative and brilliant she really was. And again, they all end up helping each other and discovering who they truly were and showing it to the world as strong and successful women in London. And I got some ideas of some places that I would like to go, like that Alex's apartment on that overlooked the river. It's a flat in Battersea with a balcony overlooking, I'm hopeful, it's the Thames. Maybe that could be a location for another girl with a fro in Battersea. Who knows? But at least I get to dream. And again, that's why I was unequivocally gave this a high review in Goodreads, because it is a very well-written book. And I hope that you will agree with me and either get the Audible version or buy your own Kindle version or some other type of electronic version of the book, because it's definitely a good read in these times. Rounding out this episode of Tennessee Fro is reading and also still writing. I've actually gotten into making comparisons of well-made screenplays, TV, as well as movies. And one of my favorite, in addition to Pride and Prejudice, and as I said, I believe it was my episode before last, the 1995 version, BBC version of Pride and Prejudice was amazing. So I started looking at other remakes, Sense of Sensibility and Emma. Great story. The remakes that did work were those that didn't stray too away from the storyline or from the premise of the story. But I've been doing several things as far as looking at great TV watching and other things that takes my mind off of the craziness of these times. For example, I have been working out all of my subscriptions. When you have multiple subscriptions to streaming services, you are able to watch a lot of these remakes. That's number one. But certain subscriptions need to be canceled, like that Irvin TV was stupid. BritBox, being the Anglophile, or because I have Anglophile tendencies, has been a godsend. I really like that. But one of my subscriptions that I've forgotten, I subscribed to until they charged me like $169, was MasterClass. My first MasterClass I listened to mostly because it was done by Timberland, and I thought it was well done. How he comes up with his beats, and he basically lives for the beat, and how he creates his songs. I thought that was amazing. But most recently, I am completed the Jodie Foster masterclass on writing screenplays, and that done by Shonda Rhimes, the teleplays. And one of the things that I took away from them, in addition to many things, is how you develop an idea into a movie for television. Well, my idea is to remake The Heiress, or Washington Square by Henry James. And how can I organize it? Well, I've started creating a script treatment or a story bible just on that premise itself. What I did take away from each one of those was just how their process is to create the great stories like Nell and Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, and how they verbalize it to newbies like me. But what I found kind of funny is I don't think Shonda Rhimes would agree with a remake, because one of her first lessons and one of her first premises is that your idea should be original. And she said taking grades and putting in a cornfield is a bad idea, or vice versa, and how she throw shade with Sex in the City, because she always gets asked, how do you write strong, smart women? I don't think she had any interest in the Carrie Bradshaw characters or the whole premise of Sex in the City, although it was obviously a commercial success. And I wonder if she would have viewed Friends, which was based on Living Single, how she would have viewed those women, because I thought, you know, Monica and Rachel were stupid. But that's just me. But she definitely threw shade at Sex in the City, because in the Grey's Anatomy story bible, she writes, she said the premise of Grey's Anatomy was like a more grounded version of Carrie's articles in Sex in the City. The surgeries are a set. They set the scene with the surgeries, personal life and relationship, and the interrelationship between that, telling the story. And she said she wanted the tone of the show to be warm, hopeful, and most of all... Wait a minute. And most of all what, girl? And most of all... young. And then she has, like, she introduces each one of the character, with the main character being a female, and then she goes over the scenes, which is the same way in the script treatment, where you basically arrange, it's just almost the same thing, but it's called a different name. There's a log line, a summary, you introduce the cast or the players, and then you have either the acts or the episodes. And I think what I'm creating now is basically a combination of a script treatment and or a story bible, whichever is it. I want to probably give enough detail that maybe I'll create it into another book. I create it into a book eventually, and then have this as backup in case anybody sees something in it. I didn't want to get hung up on the title, but the title itself is 141st in Amsterdam, because that's actually a place in Harlem. But I'm still working on the law, working out the log line. It's, and because this is based on Henry James' famous novel, Washington Park, moved slightly more uptown to 21st century Stuyvesant Harlem. The film is about a young, naive African-American woman, Catherine Cat Sloper, who falls in love with a handsome young man, Maurice Townsend, despite the objections of her emotionally abusive mother, Dr. Ophelia Sloper, who's a chief of pediatrics at Harlem Hospital, and who suspects the man of being a fortune hunter. The idea of young, naive woman, who really isn't, and the complex relationship that women have with their mothers is an ongoing theme that I think we can actually explore. And a fortune hunter in today's time, some men just ain't shit, and we know that. And the caveat of being unequally yoked with someone is not also a new theme, because this Maurice character is going to end up being a contractor, ne'er-do-well. And I just realized that I need to add in another. A character by the name of Crackhead Dan, because I can't make this dude up. Maybe Crackhead Dan actually has somebody is coming after him, and that is how little AJ gets shot. But I'm gonna have to think about that. Part of the reason AJ gets shot. I'll put that in. So the summary actually itself is very different from the 1949 screenplay and the more modern iteration, Washington Park, starring Jennifer Jason Leigh. Kat is not a mousy reject. She's the second child of her mother, Ophelia, and the love of her life, Austin Sloper, an Army Ranger, killed in action in Grenada in 1983, and her older brother, Austin Jr., killed at the age of 16, protecting her from gunfire and a gang retaliation as he returned from ROTC. Stuyvesant Row in the late 60s and 70s almost succumbed to the blight if it had not been for the forethought of several entrepreneurs like Austin and Ophelia Sloper. Austin's parents. I think I give them the name Jasper and Mamie Sloper, who would buy the house at 477 West 141st and 475. They would redo all, they bought and then restored the brownstone, and then each of the apartment homes were updated one by one. All of the storefronts remain occupied and open even when the crack, cocaine, and heroin ravaged adjacent city blocks. They work hard to salvage and restore Harlem to its glory in spite of the challenges. And when Austin Sr.'s life was cut short by the sniper bullet as his troop moved through the village, his send-off was by all accounts that of a hero. And there were pictures of a sobbing AJ. It seems like a family, but if you looked at the scene, you would actually see that the little AJ was comforting both Lavinia and his mom with a three-year-old cat off to the side. The same scene would be played 2 years, actually 5 years later. when Gangbanger's bullet catches AJ in the crossfire protecting Kat. By all accounts, Austin and AJ were the best of the best, and many felt the wrong child died that day. Kat always tried her hardest to please her mother, but never quite measured up and never felt love. We would see Kat always on the periphery of celebration, clumsy attempts at greeting her mother and meeting Maurice at a graduation party of her maternal cousins. And Ophelia wishing AJ had lived, comparing him to what she had left, Catherine. It is in this milieu that Kat meets Maurice, handsome, charismatic, but broke. Kat is taken by all the attention he lavishes on her, attention she never received before and desperately wanted, and flourishes under his affections. Kat falls madly in love with Maurice. And they plan to marry. Ophelia, in all of her obstinacy, a child health specialist and toxicologist would defend her until a frightening end. She would succumb to COVID-19. She would admit her persistent disappointment, lack of love for her own daughter. She would threaten to disown her and disinherit her. But Kat actually received $80,000 of her father's estate, and she was an amazing graphics artist, and she designed neighborhood gardens all through New York and volunteered at the co-op, and she had her own income. They would go on an extended tour. Of the British countryside. In hopes that Kat would forget Maurice, with her aunt Lavinia. Slow propendium in entertaining Maurice and pretending he was interested in her and not the younger Kat. Even more is the avarice of Maurice, who would never settle for just the $80,000. He did not know the extent of the loss of the access to the property, the rental income, and all that leasing incomes. So when Ophelia threatened disinheritance, he took it very seriously and took a job as a contractor in Florida. He would return when New York, and in particular Harlem, was starting to open back up. After the death of Dr. Sloper and Kat, playing the piano you could hear throughout the eerily quiet block. He sits on the steps and Kat speaks to him through an open window, and they sing the aria she was playing, and she asks him to return later. Maurice arrives later that night in his Jeep and he rings the bell, but Kat bolts the door, leaving Maurice locked outside, shouting her name and banging repeatedly on the locked door. Her aunt asks her how she could be so cruel, and Kat coldly responds, "I've been taught by masters." And the film fades out with Kat silently ascending the stairs while Maurice desperately cried, desperate despairing cries echo unanswered in the fading darkness. And I was also very, wanted to be very consistent in all of the characters. The only additions that I strayed away, I think, from the book was Crackhead Dan being part of the reason why AJ gets shot. Because he was trying to get away from the bangers and they were looking for him, but AJ caught that bullet. Quintus and Greer are waiters at the original party, but they were caterers and they actually managed the co-op and they actually are related to Austin. One of the things that I also wanted to relay is how all of these people, there are several circles of, or degrees of separation, but this was how this extended family survived some tremendous things, and how this young woman, Kat, had all of this loss and feeling of rejection, but that did not stop her from becoming successful in her own right. She actually had to have somebody else just tell her or remind of her strength. And even though he ended up being, Maurice being a low-life ne'er-do-well, she actually gets her, somehow gets her groove back. And that's why I don't think the actual movie itself can't be redone, but if it could be done as a limited series, ready for TV or Netflix series, done as well as the BBC 1995 version of Pride and Prejudice. This actually has so many levels, and I think it actually be done in a minimum of 14 different episodes. I'm just saying. What I have been also working on is working out how the first several scenes, given the backstory of Austin Soper being the golden child of Mamie and Jasper Sloper, and how the first several scenes of the this particular episode is how the old school slideshow with even the click and the slide sound, and then the actual scenes themselves starting to become animated. True backstory of the Sloper family was Austin Sloper was the oldest child of three sons and two daughters. The family started out as residents of the building, and then his mother was actually the maid in the family home that they managed and then would eventually buy from the original family in Hamilton Heights area of Harlem. You see black and white slides of the family at church parties and dinners in Coney Island. This family was considered the black elite of Harlem. Ophelia lived with her single mother in that building, and she and Austin were classmates. They actually grew up together. She would do her homework while she waited for him to complete ROTC drills. And when he volunteered for Special Forces, they married at Lady of Lourdes and had the reception in the family living room, which was another slide. And then you see further slides of AJ being born and growing up, multiple slides, and then there was only like one slide of Kat being born and everyone holding her except for Ophelia. And then Austin Sr. gets killed in Granada, and that's like a newsreel of that time. And then there's a slide where Ophelia and Lavinia being comforted by the 12-year-old AJ with Kat over, the 3-year-old Kat, over to the side. And then you still see the family at the gravesite, which is another slide. There are several other pictures of AJ playing and skateboarding and growing up. Then pictures of teenage AJ in his ROTC uniform, the spitting image of Austin Sr. And then there's a picture of children playing in the streets of Harlem. And then the scene speeds up and becomes animated with a 7-year-old Kat jumping rope and waiting for AJ to come home. And then you hear gunfire and you see crackhead Dan running across the scene. And then you see AJ get off the bus. You hear start with the gunfire, and then he grabs her and scoops her up. But before he can dodge, he catches a bullet in the back of his head. And then the next scene. Is the mother cradling his body. And then the graveside story. Service, I should say. And then as the time goes on, you see Kat rushing to the door to meet her mother, but her mother always repelling her and never returning her love for her only child. And then you see an older Kat, more restrained as an adult. You hear the playing of the piano through the window as her mother gets tiredly out of the car as she pulls up. And I would like it to portray just the sadness and how can you display rejection in the scenes themselves. The house itself, I would love to be a four-story old school brownstone in Hamilton Heights with antique, a combination of Anglophile, English antiques, and pictures. And one of the thing, how Ophelia rejected her only daughter, and it seems like she was competing for the memory of a husband and a brother that Catherine barely knew. And even in spite of all of this rejection and her love-starved life, how this woman still survives all of this and further loss, and she establishes her own self as a person and as a human, but at the same time rejecting even the crumbs of affection that the no-account Maurice would offer her. She eventually has to get to that point, but we don't really see that in the beginning. We just see peaks and bits of that. And one of the other things that set this apart from other period or pieces is African Americans having an inheritance and the same complex filial and interrelationship that they suffer through is apparent in the complex relationship that Kat has with her own mother and the avarice of Lavinia and how the Lavinia character, actually we find out later in the series that she wasn't even married to Reverend Penniman. She was actually his mistress, long-term mistress, for many years, and he had a whole complete family. But he never saw fit to divorce that wife and marry Ophelia, even Lavinia, even though she was from old black and landed Harlem family, and the waste of that and how she was defined. She never lived up to the her amazing golden child brother, and she was never good enough to actually marry the Reverend at that time. And I find that storyline compelling, and I'll probably somehow try to weave that in later on. This podcast is my path of entertainment and a form of therapy and an outlet for creative freedom. But if you don't have this outlet and you're struggling with depression, anxiety, or addiction, call 1-800-273-8255. It's available 24 hours a day, every day. And there's also an on-site chat feature at suicidepreventionlifeline.org/chat/. If vodka is your problem, call 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. Then there's also apps like Talkspace and Doctor on Demand that will actually be able to help you write where you are in the privacy of your car at a fraction of the cost of conventional therapy. It's okay not to be okay, and it's definitely okay to ask for help. Please navigate to www.dalesangelsinc for all special offers and updates on nerd news, as well as you can drop me a line at tennesseefroisreading@gmail.com or even leave me a 2-minute non-trolley message at 423-463-0658. All non-trolley messages may actually be read or played during the podcast. If you like what you're hearing and you want to support continued great content, please become a patron at podbean.com/thetalkingfro or put 5 on it and leave me a tip at paypal.me/FeliciaDAI. And I hope you have enjoyed this podcast as much as I have enjoyed.